What was so complex about Oedipus?
What are you afraid of if you have catagalophobia?
And what did Freud actually call the id, ego, and superego?
Take a seat and tell us how you're feeling. We'll unpack the origins and evolution of words for the inner workings of our minds on this psychological episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are on the couch on Words Unraveled, in the sense that we are delving into the human psyche and the depths of the mind.
Yes, indeed. It is all in the mind this episode. We're going to go into psychological terms, their origins, and what they actually mean as well, because there tends to be this phenomenon where we take on psychological words, the lay people, and we misuse them. Thinking of things like therapy speak, we'll get into that as well, if that's one of those things that winds you up.
Yes, yes. And we'll talk through some phobias and other interesting words that have come out of this profession, which is pretty young, right?
Is that a pun? No.
It wasn't meant to be, but yes, yes, it was. I'm a Freud. It was a pun.
Oh, I love it. So we're already into psychoanalysis. You know, actually, that's a pretty good place to start, isn't it? Psychoanalysis, Carl Jung, Sigmund Freud, because they have coined a lot of the words that we use pretty frequently. But actually, like you say, it's a young discipline, only a bit more than a century old, really. So what words do we get from Freud and Jung and their ilk?
I think this one might be one that you should start out with, because you, when we were together not so long ago, we discussed the fact that the id and the ego, which are frequently associated with Freud, are overly Latinized, and he used preceding terms in a much more straightforward way, you might say.
So we have these terms, the id, the ego, the superego, which sound very technical because they do sound Latin, but they are coined by Freud, but he doesn't use those words. Those words are used by the English translators of his work, because he writes not in English, not in Latin, certainly. He writes in German, and he does not call them the id, the ego. He calls them the es and the ich, which is nothing more than the German for the it and the I, which is amazing, I think.
There are a few other ones. The primary translators that we see are A.A. Brill and Joan Riviere, who translated a lot of the terms that he used, which were German words, into more Latinized phrases, which that tracks according to a lot of European scientific speak, so to speak.
Yeah, what's also interesting as well is that a lot of the time, the word that enters English looks Latin or Greek, and that's because it is a translation of a German word that is inspired by Latin or Greek. I'm thinking of, for example, narcissism, which is from the German Narzissmus, mm-hmm. right? Or ambivalence, right? It's from German Ambivalenz, right? Which is a German creation, but using pieces from classical languages.
One in particular that's associated with Freud, it's called transference, right? It's the notion of patients directing feelings formed in earlier relationships onto the analyst. But Freud used Übertragung, which means a carrying over or a transfer. It's the same word, but in German, with German elements.
Is it Übertragung?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, exactly. I think if you transfer some money to someone, that is also an Übertragung. It is literally transference, yeah. It's an overdragging is a good way you could translate it into English, like literally a moving from one place to another.
Weltragung then also, did I say that right? Would be...
I'd have to see it written down.
It would be...
Not to say that your pronunciation wasn't incredibly close.
Great, I tried. That's his word for repression as well, which is associated with Freud and was and has now become a psychological term in English and in related Romance languages using Latin elements after he used the German word for it.
And again, it's a word that's entered into sort of public armchair psychology as well, and speech about mental health. Also, another one that I think's quite interesting is unconscious, because a lot of people will confuse subconscious and unconscious. And we'll talk about Freud in the context of the subconscious, but actually he was interested in the unconscious mind rather than the subconscious.
Although, so what's
those
the
two concepts have obviously crossed. Well, exactly. They've basically merged with one another right now. But I mean, he's when he talks about the unconscious mind, he literally means things you do not know you are thinking.
Ah.
Right. Yeah. And that's the whole point. For example, with the Oedipus complex, which we should absolutely go into. So the Oedipus complex is the idea that boys want to murder their father and have sex with their mother, which is something that poor old Oedipus in Greek myth does do despite trying not to. You know, we'll go into some of these myths a little later in the podcast. It's worth just talking through them all. But the point is, no man knows that they have this complex, right?
But
that's the whole point. It is unconscious. So you can't actually behave in such a way intentionally that leads you in that direction. So if you do feel sexually attracted to your mother, that is not what Freud is actually talking about. He's talking about an unconscious attachment to your mother. You don't even know about. But this is the thing. It's also very hard to disprove something if the whole point of it is that, well, even if you've got it, you don't know about it.
Right, right.
Anyway.
Well, should we go into that right now? Because it does connect with Jung as well, because he has the opposite, which is the Electra complex, which has been widely discredited despite the fact that the Oedipus complex is usually considered to be a real thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with psychoanalysis, oh, by the way, psychoanalysis is Freud, and then Jung, his school of thought is known as analytic psychology. So basically, I mean, they seem like very, very similar concepts, and I'm not smart enough to delineate exactly
right
what the difference between them is, but you know.
I was a little flippant a second ago. This is extremely serious and important, well, medical and therapeutic knowledge.
Well, it is and it isn't, right? Because they're generally not taken very seriously now, these theories in even in the world of sort of psychoanalysis. But they are sort of foundational. I don't think the idea that we all do want to
right,
make love with the parent of the opposite sex is practiced that much. I mean, there obviously are people that go right back to basics and they do preach this stuff. But generally, I don't want to say discredited, but a lot of it has been sort of set aside. So you can be sort of flippant about it.
Freud boiled a lot of these notions down into bodily functions. The things that control our inner psyche are often, per his analysis, related right to our mouths, the way we eat, our waist, etc. He had these stages: the oral stage, the anal stage, the phallic stage,
yeah,
the latent stage, the genital stage, and all of this sounds very all of this is very physical.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about someone being anally retentive, we're referring to Freud's theory, mm-hmm, right? If you have one of these fixations, oral, anal, whatever, sometimes these just pop up in everyday speech in the idioms that we use, which is kind of amazing. Sometimes we're using Freud when we don't know we are, or Jung when we don't know we are. If we talk about someone having a complex, full stop, we're using Jungian verbiage. When we talk about introverts and extroverts, we're talking in Jungian speak, because he turned those terms from adjectives, you can be introvert or be extrovert, he turned them into nouns, you know, you can be a introvert or an extrovert. Although, you know, here's a funny thing about the word extrovert, he was really annoyed by the spelling extrovert, which is the one that we generally use now, because he said it was bad Latin. It should be extravert and introvert.
Mm-hmm. Extra outward, intro inward. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. But we said we were going to talk about Oedipus and Electra, didn't we?
Yes, we did. You did.
I've never really paid enough attention to the story of Oedipus, so I did have a good old read of it ahead of this. Can I run you through it? And
sure, yeah. This is, I actually really enjoyed this play. I've read it a few times.
Right, so the play is Oedipus Rex. Yeah, he sometimes gets referred to as Oedipus Tyrannus, right?
Mm-hmm.
King Oedipus, which is what he eventually becomes. But to start with, he's not a king at the start of the story. He's a little baby, uh-huh, isn't he?
Who immediately is the victim of a murder attempt.
Yeah, that's it. So his father has been told that his son is going to try and kill him and have sex with his wife. So Oedipus's father, who's called Laios, who's the king of Thebes, or the ruler of Thebes, and his wife, Jocasta, they give baby Oedipus to a slave and tell them to leave him on the side of a mountain where he'll get gobbled up by beasts. The slave decides they don't want to do that. They give him to a shepherd instead. And the shepherd takes him to Corinth. And in Corinth, he gets adopted by the king of Corinth, Polybus. Later on, when he's a bit older, Oedipus discovers that he is a bastard and wants to find out, you know, who his parents are. So he leaves for Delphi to consult the oracle to Apollo about his heritage. But the oracle tells him, oh, by the way, you're destined to kill your dad and have sex with your mum. So fearing that, he doesn't return to Corinth. Instead, he goes to Thebes because he thinks that's a safe place to go. On the way there, he encounters a man in the road who gives him a hard time, and he kills him. Whoops. And then when he gets to the walls of Thebes, he is set a challenge by a sphinx. Of course he is. No one has ever passed the challenge of the sphinx, which is a riddle, but Oedipus manages to solve the riddle. The riddle being, which animal has one voice but 2, 3, or 4 feet, being slowest on three? The answer being man. I can't get my head around why that is.
That's the same. It's the same notion as the riddle, what walks on 4 legs, then 2 legs, then 3 legs. And it's also a person. Like, you crawl when you're a baby, you stand on 2 legs when you're an adult, and then you walk with a cane when you're older.
The third leg's a cane. I'm not happy with that. I'm not happy with that. I'm sorry, Sphinx, but I think that's a bit of a swizz. Anyway, and because he is, you know, the sole person to pass the Sphinx's test, he gets made king because the position is vacant because the king's just died and his poor widow's left with no husband. So he ends up taking the king's place and marrying the king's widow. Of course, it turns out that the king's widow is his mum.
Yep.
They have some kids. He doesn't know it. And it turns out the man in the road that he's killed is the former king, now dead, his dad. And when he finds out that he has done exactly as prophesied, he blinds himself, which is extreme.
Total normal reaction.
Yeah, and his mum kills herself. Oopsie poopsie. Whoops. It's all gone a bit wrong. So that is the story of Oedipus. Do you object to how I pronounce Oedipus, by the way? Because I've heard it pronounced Oedipus.
I don't think so. But I usually say Oedipus, and I have heard it.
Yeah.
I've heard it said that way.
I think it is a transatlantic difference. Yeah, I think so. And then the deal with Electra, it doesn't fit quite as perfectly with the, you know, just the perfect inverse of the Oedipus complex, which is what the Electra complex is. But, you know.
Electra is the daughter of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra in Greek myth, and she helped kill her mother to avenge her father. And Jung uses this term to describe a girl's competition with her mother for her father's attention during that phallic stage that we mentioned, when children form early attachments and rivalries. And then modern psychology was like, no, no thanks. And then, and most major diagnostic manuals and such do not consider it to be a thing. But I have you watched Frasier?
I have.
I love that show. I have also watched it many times. One of my favorite lines is when Niles, who is Frasier's brother, stands in for him on his radio show. He says, well, Frasier is a Freudian, I am a Jungian, so there'll be no blaming mother today.
That show is so dorky sometimes.
Oh, it's so good though. I think it might be why I am the way I am, because I watched it when I was about 8.
We have a few psychological terms from myth, from Greek myth. I was looking up a few of these. Obviously, we do have narcissism, which is obviously from the story of Narcissus, the handsome youth who is cursed to fall in love with his reflection in a pool. Of course, a love that he can never actualize because he's made of water, but it's just
him. You know.
Bless him. But what I found interesting while researching this was the earliest sort of use of that term in psychological contexts was by a guy called Paul Nacker. He was credited by Freud as using it first, and it was that German word, Narzissmus, to describe basically a sexual perversion in which you are turned on by your own body. So the original narcissism is excessive masturbation.
Huh. Oh, yeah.
I can hear
that
the sound
sense.
Of this video being demonetized as I say
this
these
is
words.
Clinical. This is.
Yeah, exactly. But also, sort of a little bit later, it's interpreted as a perfectly normal part of childhood development. So, a sort of interest in your own body. But if you revert to that when you're an adult and you become sort of a little bit obsessed with your own looks and your own handsomeness, then yeah, that's a problematic form of narcissism.
And then presumably that was extended to being overly invested in your own sense of, I don't know, value.
Vanity.
Yeah, vanity. There you go.
Yeah, vanity. Although I think even before it was used clinically, Samuel Taylor Coleridge uses the word narcissism. In fact, he's the earliest citation for two forms of it, narcissism and narcissine. Both appear, it seems, in the poetry of Coleridge first, but they're, you know, they basically say, you know, behaving like Narcissus, and that is, you know, a byword for vanity.
What other words come from myth?
Well, there's echolalia, which is, again, a normal part of speech development, but also can be a symptom of adult mental health problems. Echolalia is named after Echo, so Narcissus's not lover, actually, unrequited lover. She falls in love with Narcissus. Echo is, oh, bless her. She was a chatty nymph who was chatting away to Hera while Zeus was getting up to no good. And Hera blames her for distracting her.
Of course.
And so curses her to only ever be able to repeat the words of others.
Ah.
And then because she's so in love with Narcissus and Narcissus isn't interested, he's too in love with his own reflection, she pines and pines until she no longer exists but for her voice. And so that's what an echo is. And echolalia means echo speech. And it's something that, I mean, I'm seeing it right now from my little daughter.
Aww.
It's where you just repeat what other people are saying, you know, and it is a very normal part of learning to speak. You know, someone says something to you and you make their noise back at them. Someone says to you, banana, and they go, nana, back
Aww.
At you. Echolalia.
What was her first word?
She did the usual, but, you know, mama. Although she flits between dada and papa because my French wife and I are locked in battle. Mm-hmm. Over that one. Genuinely, the first one was banana. She really loves banana, but it comes out as nana because I did a video about how babies acquire words. And one of the things they do as they're learning is to spot the patterns in languages. And when you get a borrowed word like banana, where the emphasis, for example, is you know, the second syllable, when in English normally you expect the emphasis to be on the first syllable, then they get confused. So that's why they say nana or pewter instead of computer. So it's nana, and it's adorable.
That is adorable. The lalia bit in echolalia is also in a Freudian era term. This is late 19th century from Georges Gilles de la Tourette, who coined the term coprolalia, which it described the, you'll recognize his last name as being the name of a syndrome. He used this term to describe the use of specifically involuntary obscene language in patients with neurological disorders. This was well before what we now call Tourette's syndrome was well understood, and it specifically focused on obscene language. So coprolalia means dung speak.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, like, I was going to throw out the word coprophile there as if it's a normal word to
That's
know.
Also one of those words, and it means the same thing, but attraction to that. So,
yes, but now we understand Tourette's syndrome does not have to involve obscenity. Also, when we're talking about myth and psychology, we should talk about the fact that Psyche is the goddess of the soul in Greek mythology. She's eventually the goddess of the soul. She starts off as a mortal, as a princess who falls in love with Eros. Well, rather, he falls in love with her. She gets tricked into looking at him when she's not supposed to look at his face. It's a whole long story that involves her being set a load of tasks by Aphrodite. These tasks include having to sort a pile of different grains by nightfall, but luckily a helpful swarm of ants do it for her. She's also tasked with having to collect the golden fleece of these raging rams that have the golden fleece. But then she's advised by, it's like a fir or a reed advises her, talking reed, tells her, you know what you could do? You could just wait until night and collect it off the bushes, which is what she ends up doing instead. Anyway, she ends up finding Eros in the underworld. And he makes her immortal so that she can come back to life after she accidentally looks into a box she shouldn't have looked in. I'm telling this story so well. It's really get Stephen Fry to tell these stories instead of me, isn't it?
You're doing a wonderful job.
But it's one of those things. So Psyche means soul in ancient Greek and is also the goddess of soul.
Soul and breath and life, kind of in the same way as animal, right? Also means breath and life and spirit. And Plato and Aristotle later would use de anima, right, as this principle that organized living bodies. And a lot of that got ported over into late 19th century psychology terms. We also have others from literature like archetypes and things, which Jung applied to family archetypes like the mother and the father and things like that.
It's interesting how these terms like spirit and soul and life do get changed, and mind, and how they swap around. So now we talk about psychology as the study of the mind, but quite literally, it's the study of the soul.
Before Freud and Jung and their fellows got a hold of these or developed these terms and ported them over into the science of psychology and psychiatry, the terms that we used for mental illness and mental conditions were not kind, right? Even as recently as 1845, England had a Lunacy Act, for example.
So this is the idea that your moods are inspired by the moon.
Right, of course. And we also have related terms like lunatic and moonstruck and things like that, describing the same notion. The best legacy that you can describe from Freud and Jung would be that they took these conditions more seriously and started talking about them in ways that weren't just, we'll put them in an asylum, you know?
Yeah, they're ultimately trying to find the root cause of them so that they can be treated.
The notion of being moonstruck or moonsick or a lunatic also dates back to Old English. There was moonshick, which literally means moonsick, and then monath sekonas, which means moonsickness as well. The word moonstruck, though, is from Paradise Lost originally. And then, of course, loony is a variation on lunatic.
Ah, right. Okay, yeah. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And it's one of these things that words that were sort of clinical at the time do become insulting later on.
There were some attempts to clinicalize mental health before this. They weren't great. But for example, there was a British physician named Thomas Sutton who tried to describe delirium and things like that. He used the term delirious for the symptoms of alcohol abuse, the psychological symptoms of alcohol abuse. And that word is actually really interesting because it very nearly literally means to be off the rails. The root there means furrow. So deliriare in Latin means to go off a furrow, and was used in Latin as in reference to mental illness, which is interesting.
I'm just thinking of the famous Belgian brewery called Delirium.
Yes.
Delirium Tremens. Mm-hmm. What is that, Delirium Tremens? We've talked about it before.
It's like the shakes from alcohol abuse.
And it's also the state in which you see the pink elephants.
Yes, exactly.
It's why their logo is
a pink elephant.
If we're talking about people who coined words that we use all the time when talking about psychology, we should talk about Eugen Bleuler.
Eugen Bleuler.
Who has the most incredible name. Eugen Bleuler. I think you were just telling me his name was something really dull, actually.
His first name is Paul. His name is Paul Eugen Bleuler, which I don't know. Is Paul pronounced differently in Swiss?
I mean, if he's speaking German, it's Paul.
Paul.
But yeah, Paul Eugen Bleuler.
There we go.
He coined schizophrenia, for example. The term was, the condition was being referred to as dementia praecox, before he called it schizophrenia. But obviously, again, these words are all coined in German. So he talked about schizophrenie, right, is the German pronunciation of it. But he also talked about schizophrenien, which means schizophrenias, because there are a variety of different ones. But in describing schizophrenia, he also coined two other terms that we use. One I already mentioned, ambivalence, mm-hmm. which is having two coexisting but profoundly opposing emotions, beliefs, attitudes. And another one that he coined as a symptom of schizophrenia is autism, a word that we do use a great deal, which he coined as a detachment from reality. But obviously, as we understand autism more and more, we don't really think of it as that at all anymore.
You mentioned him and these words in your show recently.
I did. Yes, I did.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming over to see it in London. Jess was so generous. She came to both shows, which is both generous and terribly, terribly patient.
I thought it was excellent. It was fun to compare. If Rob does this again, I highly recommend going to see it because it was a fantastic show at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London. And he did two in one day because the first one sold out.
Well, thank you for bragging on my behalf, Jess. But the most exciting part of it was having you around and getting to show you bits of London, but also bits of Derbyshire as well. We had a lovely time up at Chatsworth House.
We had tea at Mr. Darcy's house.
Pride and Prejudice. Mr. Darcy's house. With Martin as well, who's editing this video.
Very fun. I did not feel ambivalent about any of that, as a matter of fact, which you discussed in particular because there's a modern usage of ambivalent that means you don't really care one way or another, but in the context of a symptom of schizophrenia, which means a splitting of the mind, ambivalence means strength valentia, like valence electrons and things like that, on strength on both sides, ambi being both sides.
Basically, it is a spin-off of the word equivalence.
Right, it's having two equally strong opinions.
Bleuler thinks we've got equivalence. We need an opposite of equivalence. And he creates ambivalence. And I was making the point that the word ambivalence is kind of skunked. It's a word that's through having two different meanings is basically useless now because half the people that you use it towards will think you mean you've got strong feelings, but in two directions, that you're conflicted. And the other half will think that you don't really care.
When you asked the audience to raise their hands about that definition, I was surprised at how many people raised their hands for having that sort of like blasé, not caring sense or associating it with not caring one way or another, because I've always, I've always thought of it as being torn.
Well, I mean, that is a truer relation
it's
of
older,
its meaning
maybe
as
not truer.
Coined by Bleuler. Yeah, exactly. But I think I hear ambivalent used more often to mean not really caring either way.
To your point about Bleuler, you mentioned he coined the term autism, but he used it to refer to symptoms that he believed were caused by schizophrenia. And then it changed. It was applied in 1938 to the condition we now consider to be called autism by Hans Asperger, who is associated with the now we don't use the term anymore, but Asperger's syndrome was used for a while for a similar condition in child psychology. Let's talk about some things that scare us. Let's talk about fears and phobias a little bit.
Now, I get a bit grumpy when we've talked about these in the past, because you can basically coin a fear for anything
you
want. I want ones that exist.
You don't want hippopotamonstro sesquipedalia phobia.
The fear of long words.
Right. With a bunch of like stupid multilingual roots and bits on it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you've got an even greater fear of... Actually, no, I think you're more of a file than a phobe of
yes,
of, what are they called? Not compound, hybrid words.
Hybrid words and whatnot. They're a lot of fun. But anyway, phobia, phobos is Greek and it means fear or literally flight from something. The phobias existed in Greek medical contexts first, but one of the earliest phobia words to appear in English was hydrophobia, which is recorded as early as the 14th century as another word for rabies, which is one of the classic symptoms of rabies is still called hydrophobia, and it's because you physically can't swallow. It's terrifying.
All around bad place to be is suffering from rabies.
Another interesting thing here, so psychology research that we've been talking about from this era, late 19th, early 20th century, ported that terminology into more public discourse around fears, including like nationality and gender identity and sexual preference and stuff, which we see in like xenophobia and homophobia, which are more biases than fears, right? But they're rooted, the notion is that they're rooted in fear. An interesting twist, the word homophobia originally meant fear of humans and most commonly was used in the context of animals. Before the mid-20th century, a homophobic horse was one that didn't like people. And it's because it's using the Latin sense of homo seen in the term homo sapiens. It meant human and was related to the word hominid. However, most English words that incorporate homo, like homonym and homogenous, are using the unrelated Greek homos, meaning same, which is why homophobia's meaning shifted to describe first a clinical fear of people who sexually or romantically prefer the same sex and then fear-fueled hatred of them later, which I think is kind of neat.
That makes so much sense now you've just explained it like that.
Right?
Because you could easily interpret homophobia as also being fear of men.
Yeah.
Right. And therefore homosexuality being, you know, sexual attraction to men. But what homosexuality is actually is sexual attraction to the same.
Many phobias, however, are still mostly found in like psychological health contexts. The American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, has an official list of philias and also phobias, philias being like paraphilias, also known as kinks. But their phobia list includes things like arachibuterophobia. Do you know what that means? Can you guess?
I do know this because I put it in my newsletter a few weeks back. it's peanut butter. Is it fear of having peanut butter stuck to the roof of your mouth?
I don't know, actually. I just know it means fear of peanut butter.
I think it's one of those ones where if you look at these on the internet, what you often find is it'll say this word means a fear of and then complex explanation, but actually the etymology of the word, the breakup of the word, is actually much simpler. So in that case, all over the internet it says the fear of getting peanut butter stuck to the top of the roof of your mouth, but actually what it literally says is fear of peanut butter. There was this other one about fear that a duck is secretly watching you. You ever come across this one? It's anatidaphobia. It literally means is just fear of ducks. You know, it doesn't actually mean fear that a duck is secretly watching you, but it comes from the context of, I think it's from a Far Side comic. It's said in the comic to describe the fear that a duck is watching you.
This is related to the Samuel Johnson word, anatiferous, meaning producing ducks. We talked about this in our dictionary episode. One of the weird words you'll find in Samuel Johnson's dictionary is anatiferous, which means producing ducks.
Producing ducks.
And I can't remember whether we figured out what it was, but we speculated that it had something to do with the notion of like barnacle geese being born from trees and barnacles and whatnot.
Not just a very, very specific word for what producing one duck ducks might do.
A couple other ones, like real ones, include amaxophobia or hamaxophobia, meaning fear of riding in a car, with the Greek root meaning carriage. I guess it could also apply to carriages. We got fear of failure, which is atichophobia, which the Greek root there means unfortunate. There's cacophobia, which is fear of ugliness.
Yeah.
Greek kakos, which
yeah, which just means fear of bad, doesn't it, really? It just means fear of badness.
I mean, it's also from the same root as the word defecate.
Yes. Yeah. And cacophony as well. Bad sound. Euphobia would be a good sort of contrasting one, which is often said as being a fear of hearing good news. That's what the internet will tell you it means, but literally it just means good phobia.
I said that it's related to the word defecate. It's not. It's from a Proto-Indo-European root that means defecate. different thing.
And it is related to the word cack.
Yeah,
though,
it
isn't
is.
It?
Uh-huh. And caca and things like that. All of the above.
Caca. Yeah, indeed. These are all beautiful. I'm glad we got to caca. Uh-huh.
I like the flow of catagalophobia, meaning fear of being ridiculed, which I think we all probably have a little bit of. I mean, I suppose you can have like a fear of it to the degree that you can't go out in public or something to that extent. But I don't know that anyone really wants to be ridiculed.
No, and I always think of a phobia, for it to be a phobia, it needs to be to some extent irrational.
So that's got to be, it's the intensity.
Mm-hmm. There shouldn't be a phobia of being mauled by a lion, right? Because that would be, that's a thing worth being scared of. It's not a phobia. It's perfectly... It's perfectly rational. Ergophobia is a good one. Have you come across this?
Oh, tell me.
We've talked about ergo before when we've talked about the word ergonomics.
Fear of work?
It's a fear of work. Yeah. Uh-huh. Ergophobia.
That's why we podcast for a living.
Indeed. We're terrible ergophobes. And also we'd mentioned not that long ago about agoraphobia. Agora being named after the agora, as in like the meeting place in ancient Greece, because it was massive, basically. And so that if you're scared of large places full of people, then you'd be scared of the agora.
I get a little bit of it, people have kind of pop culturalized this one because it's not actually something that's crippling in any sense. I'm sure for some people it is, but megalophobia, there are a couple of subreddits dedicated to this, and you just see very big things and it makes your stomach drop a little bit. Like if you see a wide shot of a blue whale, it always makes me go like, it's not scary. It's just like, it's a little bit of a little tingly.
If I could just draw a link between everything we've said here and our broader theme of psychology, it's that none of these words were known to the ancient Greeks.
Right.
You have to point all of this out. They did not have all of these phobias. They've all been coined since. Ditto, they did not have the word psychology either. The word psychology is a much more recent invention. And basically, well, most of those words that start with psycho were unknown to the ancient Greeks.
Yeah, there were treatises that described the way the mind works, but not to the extent or to the degree of nuance that we see later in 19th century and 20th century psychology contexts. A couple more silly phobias before we get off this train would be phobophobia, which is fear of phobias. And then if you need a word for the fear of Friday the 13th, then it's periskavidekatriophobia. Periskavidekatriophobia.
So which bit of that is Friday?
Periskevi is the Greek for Friday. And then Dekatreus is 13.
There's also this zemiphobia, which is fear of the great mole rat. But I don't know why that exists.
I think they're kind of ugly cute, but I can also see why they would be scary.
And a lot of the time these words have been coined for a specific moment. And then they make it into these online lists because they're a bit funny. And then here we are, perpetuating them.
Yes, we are. They're fun to think about.
They are fun to think about because they also lead you towards the roots of these words, which then lead you to the roots of other words. That's why it's worth talking about cacophobia, right?
Yes, indeed.
Jess, I want to talk about the pretty modern phenomenon of therapy speak.
Is this when people sort of self-diagnose on the internet?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Absolutely. Okay. So actually, I was struggling with how I would define this myself. So I looked up a paper on it and I'll just read you their definition if you want. This is by two Spanish researchers. They wrote this last year, Carme Izen Mas and Manuel Almagro. And they say therapy speak refers to a modern linguistic trend, a sort of linguistic practice, particularly present among privileged people, characterized by the imprecise and superficial use of psychotherapy language, originally developed by mental health professionals for clinical settings in everyday communication by people who are not mental health professionals and whose main concern is not mental health, especially within online, social, and personal realms. Okay, that's a bit of a mouthful. I think the best thing I can do is give you some examples of what are considered therapy speak in therapy circles, right? So by people who work in the field, the words that they think that people are misusing more broadly. So in this paper, they say outside of therapy sessions, people are using set boundaries, hold space, reject toxicity. People are warned about the dangers of gaslighting, narcissism, and love bombing. That people are talking about others as being toxic or abusive, codependent. They're talking about coping mechanisms, traumas, anxieties, emotional triggers, being a bit depressed or a bit OCD or a bit bipolar, or, you know, practicing self-care, using these terms outside of a clinical context and using them in a way that devalues the terms themselves, basically, and takes all of the sort of precision out of them.
I could imagine that someone who has severe obsessive compulsive disorder to the point where it hinders them from living their lives in the way that they want to and who are being treated for that might hear people who prefer cleanliness in their house but do not have a diagnosable form of that disorder or condition being frustrated that their condition is being trivialized or described in a non-clinical way.
But also there's a way in which it's being used by one person to sort of essentially abuse another.
Calling someone narcissistic as a weapon.
Yeah, exactly. Or talking about boundaries when emotional or relationship boundaries, when what actually you're doing is imposing strict controls on someone. Right? Saying, oh, so the boundary, okay, so I'll mention who this is all, who I'm thinking of here is Jonah Hill, right? Supposedly leaked text messages from him to his then girlfriend. This was back in 2023. Talked about boundaries in this way. He told his ex-girlfriend, Sarah Brady, who was a professional surfer, that she wasn't allowed to surf with men, post pictures of herself wearing a bathing suit, model, or have friendships with women who are in unstable places. So you can hear the therapy speak coming through there. And he describes that as his boundaries for a romantic relationship. So using therapy speak there to disguise what is clearly pretty coercive behavior. That's one of the problems of it as well.
Yeah, describing people you're disagreeing with as toxic as well, I think.
But this is also one of the problems set out in this paper, is that these words are coined. You have to coin words for all manner of condition, because, you know, it's sometimes said something doesn't exist unless it has a name. So you do need to have terms for these things. And a lot of time these terms are invented to sort of empower someone to be able to overcome that situation. But now what is often happening is that the people who are the suppressors are able to, this is why they mention the word privilege, right? Are able to take those words and use them with a completely different interpretation against the people that designed to try and help. It's a good example of it outside of therapy speak is, for example, the word woke, right? The word woke is originally coined to help enable people to be more socially aware, to encourage it. But in the end, it ends up being adopted by other people as an insult, you know, which is, yeah, obviously a problem.
Which always strikes me as a little funny, because, like, is the opposite of that asleep?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people that use it that way think that far ahead, but I don't know. Anyway, I got on my little high horse there, on my big high horse, right. A little bit there.
This reminds me of the way that earlier terms, like pre-scientific psychiatry terms, or even like turn of the 20th century terms for people with mental disabilities, have been pejorated as well, have been turned into insults. Words like imbecile and moron and things like that were maybe misused in a clinical setting from our perspective, but were used sort of not as insults prior and then have become insults because we have learned that they are, either they've been oversimplified, they've been abused, they've been used as insults, or their meaning has just been lost entirely. Or their original meaning has been lost entirely.
That's the point. You know, they get coined for a reason and then their meaning gets distorted. And then you end up having to coin another term.
Yes.
And then the cycle starts again.
And they get more specific over time as we understand more about our brains, which is good, I think.
I don't know if you came across this at the time, but there was a post on TikTok. It was back in 2023 by a therapist who... Well, the title was How to Break Up with a Friend, thumbs up emoji. In it, she used phrases like, And this is what you're supposed to say to your friend if you no longer want to hang out with them. Oof. I've treasured our season of friendship, but we're moving in different directions in life. I don't have the capacity to invest in our friendship any longer. One of the big complaints in this paper is that, you know, you shouldn't have clinicians telling people outside of the industry how to use these words wrongly, right? And how to weaponize them basically to convey quite mean messages.
Yeah. That was very upsetting. You just said that to me. Yeah.
I would never say that, Jess. Aww. I will always treasure our season of friendship.
Aww.
Have we come to the end of our season of podcast, by which I mean not the actual full season, I just mean this podcast. I was trying to be clever. It's not worked.
Yeah. Today, it's good. The podcast has ended. our session, our session is over.
Bye.
We'll see you next time on Words Unraveled.